musical mushrooms, and coastal shores. The conference runs February 20th through March 1st. Learn more by following Single Thread Theater on Instagram and get your tickets now via performanceandxr.com. See you there.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
And good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and this is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, in the first and well into the second hour, from a September 21st, 2025, Kingston Writers Fest event called Wild Rides that has not yet aired on this show. You'll hear a conversation between authors Ian Williams and Maria Riva. This nearly 80-minute conversation and reading will run uninterrupted into and nearly halfway through the second hour. In the first hour, following the end of that event, you'll hear a January 8th Novel Idea Bookstore book launch reading with Harlequin Crow, launching their debut book of poetry called Queer Holla. This second feature should begin very close to 5:30, so I think it's... There are always things that happen during a show that change how things lay out in a live show, as these always are. So, but it should be somewhere around 5:30 when that begins to air. My usual just start of the announcement is occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. And just a second announcement, I've been doing this lately too because I have been, I think this is the sixth Kingston Writers Fest event that I've aired. Most of them are in that 80 to 90 minute range. I usually at the end of each hour announce the blog space, but I can't do that in the first hour and haven't been able to a number of times, which is great because I can do that now, and then I'll probably do it midpoint again in the second hour when that ends, and then again at the end of the hour. So get a few shots at it. But just because as I was saying, I don't have a chance to work with my usual end of the hour announcement, I'll just do it now. And it's just a reminder that every week I upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They will remain there for 3 years. I usually get that uploaded at right around 7 o'clock in the evening after I get home from the radio station. So I'm going to do two things. I'm going to announce, in case someone happened to tune in a minute or two late and didn't hear what is going to be featured in the first 80 minutes of this show. So I'll do that. And then I want to read a short, a synopsis or a short blurb from Kingston Writers Fest's program guide that they put out every year that talks specifically about the events. So I will do those two things, and then you'll get to hear. How's that? Okay, from again, the September 21st, 2025 Kingston Writers Fest event called Wild Rides. Again, it hasn't aired on the show yet. You'll hear a conversation between authors Ian Williams and Maria Riva. This nearly 80-minute conversation and reading will run, I don't know if I mentioned this at the top of the hour either, anyway, so, but it will run uninterrupted into and halfway through the second hour. And as a mini introduction to it, I kind of already said that, but here, from their Kingston Writers Fest 2025 program guide, this was event number 12 and called, again, Wild Rides, and here's what it says about it. You've changed, that's a title, you've changed the eagerly awaited new novel by Giller Prize winner Ian Williams is a sharp, inventive, and absurdly funny dissection of a marriage between people who can no longer recognize each other. In Endling, again, another title, a mix of extinction science, the international bride trade, and Russia's war against Ukraine, Maria Riva spins fiction with all-too-real life. It says, join a conversation between the creators of two of the most dazzling and buzzworthy novels of the year, last year. So here again is, and as mentioned, that event, and I'm just going to see if I'm all set up and just jump right into it. How's that? Here we go.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Kingston Writers Fest. My name is Sarah Tieng, and as a member of the Kingston Writers Fest Festival Committee, I'm very pleased to introduce event number 12, Wild Rides. And it's going to be a wild ride, right, Ian and Maria? It's going to be super wild. Please note, our land acknowledgement is also on the screen in the foyer. I wanted to talk a little bit about how we try to honor the Anishinaabe and the Haudenosaunee peoples who lived here before us and still call it home, and that we are so grateful for the opportunity to share this space that is so rich in history, language, and storytelling. In a moment, I will introduce our authors, but first, a few words about the event itself. It will last for approximately an hour and a half, which includes a Q&A at the end, so make sure you have all your questions ready. You'll be able to come to the mic, which is going to be front and center, to ask your questions. If you have any mobility concerns, you can just raise your hand and an usher will come to you with a mic. I'd like to draw your attention as well to the Penn Canada Empty Chair. As we gather to celebrate our freedom to write and to read, this vacant chair symbolizes the absence of a writer whose defense of these freedoms has led to their persecution and imprisonment. You'll find more information on the Penn Canada website. Please do check it out. Freedom of speech is at an all-time low. We'd also, Kingston Writers Fest, would also like to thank the sponsor of this wonderful event, Burgundy Dunn of Viridius Lex LLP, Jen Walter and Steve Isco, author patrons of Maria Riva, and Trish Krause and Nancy Evans, author patrons of Ian Williams. We are also grateful to the City of Kingston Arts Fund, the Ontario Arts Council, and the Canada Council for the Arts, as well as the many institutions, businesses, and individuals who support the festival, and all of our incredibly dedicated volunteers who work long hours for the love of books. So to all of them, thank you. Okay, for the usual housekeeping details, please mute any devices that might ring or beep. In every single session I've hosted so far, there's been at least one, so even if you think you have it off, check, please. You can also refrain from taking pictures or recording the event. We do have a festival photographer whose photographs will be posted on our website daily. Okay, now it is my pleasure to introduce our absolutely fabulous authors. Ian Williams is famous for his highly original, often offbeat style, which is not only popular, but award-winning, like heavily award-winning. His poetry collection, Personals, was shortlisted for the Griffin Poetry Prize. His short story collection, Not Anyone's Anything, won the Danutic Lead Literary Award for Short Fiction. And his debut novel, Reproduction, won the Giller Prize. He puts one out, it will get a prize. Of Reproductions, Williams said, it should read like a good love story. That's the only thing I want to read and write or care about in people's lives. The same applies to his latest novel, You've Changed, the story of a love triangle twisted by unseen pressures in unexpected ways. Maria Riva's first book, an anthology of short stories titled Good Citizens Need Not Fear, dissects the turbulent 70s and 80s in Ukraine with her trademark dark humor through a cast of unforgettable characters that weave the stories together. Now in her daring and improbable debut novel, Endling, also set in the Ukraine, she somehow deftly blends snail sex, sham brides, and the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, blending horror and absurdism to craft a metafiction tale that explores the ethics of writing about war and conflict. Anne Patchett calls it funny and smart. This is essential reading. Please join me in welcoming Maria Riva and Ian Williams.
Hello, everybody. You can hear me? You can hear Ian?
Here. Hi, everyone. I'm Kingston again.
Excellent. Well, good news and bad news. Good news, I finished off the festival wine right before coming here. Bad news, this is a recorded event, so I have to be quite polished. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while. And it's not too often you see just like two authors in conversation, like with the intervention. And so who knows where it's going to go exactly.
It's going to be a wild ride.
And then there'll be a part at the end for audience questions. So. Feel free. Where do you want to start?
Well, should we introduce our books and what they're about?
Yeah, the about what are, okay. Is that me to do it first?
Or? Yes, since I asked the question, you have to answer it.
So, You've Changed is a departure from reproduction. So, when I wrote Reproduction, it was this big multi-generation story, right? Three generations forward. It kept expanding and expanding and expanding. And I wanted to do something that was very different. I wanted to write something on a very small and intimate scale, reduced cast, so not generations all through time, but just two people in a marriage. So they couldn't escape the novel. They were locked into the relationship and the novel. And it asked questions about, so how much pressure can a marriage withstand? And other questions about beauty. What does it mean to be aging and female and pursuing beauty? When does that cross over to something more pernicious and dangerous? On the husband's side, like how much of our identities are wrapped up in work? And when we lose our work, do we lose ourselves, right? And then putting these pressures together, if two people are diverging and growing in their own direction, can the marriage container still kind of keep them together? I'm sure people in this room, you have your own experiences with marriage. This is a book about marriage by a man who's not married. Just like Reproduction is a book about reproduction by a man who doesn't have kids. I feel like that space is the most like fascinating for me, right? To live this parallel life, right? Like if there were ever a biography, like it would just be a biography of his imaginary life, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, how would you describe it?
So when they say, write what you know, you're like, snap, F that.
No pleasure in that.
Okay, so my book is also in a way about marriage, some of it. So it's about the marriage industry in Ukraine that used to exist. So first I'll backtrack. And what inspired this was a conversation my sister had with her airplane neighbor. So my sister is a renowned composer. She was doing Anna Pokorna. I got to do the name plug. So she was on her way to Princeton at the time to pursue her PhD. And her airplane neighbor was an American fellow. And as soon as they got to talking and she said she was born in Ukraine, this man said, well, gosh, I would really love a Ukrainian girl as a wife because American women are so ambitious and aggressive. And she told me this story, and I would have really loved to have seen her face in that moment. Because my sister is not someone you would want to cross in an alley. Like, she's like, you know, she holds her own. So then I started wondering, what are people in North America saying about Eastern European women and Slavic women? So I actually went onto English language Google and I typed in Ukrainian women. and the results were really underwhelming. They were mostly about how to date Ukrainian women. And so that's how I learned about this marriage industry that used to exist before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, that would bring in men from all over the world into Ukraine, sold under this promise that they would find the perfect docile bride, untainted by feminism and modernity. And so basically folks who were very disenchanted with their local dating pools. And it's not so far-fetched, because everyone I talk to about their local dating pools, everyone's pretty disenchanted and dissatisfied. Everyone in Vancouver's like, Vancouver's the worst place to date people, you just have to go to somewhere else, right? So I wanted to focus on 13 of these grooms who go to Ukraine to find their perfect brides, and they have the unfortunate luck of being kidnapped by activists who are trying to bring this entire industry down.
Mm. So yeah. It started with the marriage plot, rather than with the snails or the science or with the...
Yeah, that's right. I was really writing about that specific industry, and I started the book in 2018. And then I was trying to understand the motivations behind everyone in these romance tours, right? And they're these, basically these highly packed itineraries that lead the men through different cities in Ukraine, and there's all these icebreakers and socials, etc., speed dating sessions. And so I was exploring the motivations of the men to come there, but I also wanted to see what are the women there doing, and do they actually want to get married? And I decided no, none of them do. And so there are the activists who are infiltrating the industry, and then there's also a biologist who is using proceeds from these tours to fund her mobile lab, which is trying to save snails from the brink of extinction. Yeah, so she's trying to get them to reproduce.
Yeah, I learned a lot about snails.
Me too.
The page, like, dog-eared there. Yeah, so, I mean, folks like to know, like, what a book is about, and so you get a sense of plot, right? But even, like, hearing you describe it, like, there's so much more that happens in a book apart from, like, it's more than about the marriage industry there. How does your book work?
How does it work?
Yeah, how does it work? If it were, like, a watch or something, how would you explain how it progresses then? How does it move through time?
Right. I imagine a train going along its rails, and it's like 4 years into its trajectory. It's, like, going full speed, and then the train completely derails and falls off the tracks.
That's weirdly apt.
Yeah, we'll get into the derailment, but that is what I imagine the novel to be. How does your novel work?
It's in three parts, and after each part, there's a major kind of, like, formal change that happens, right? So the story, the characters are changing, they're evolving, but then the book itself does this kind of pivot, right, at every third. So the second third, it starts censoring and editing itself, right? You'll see it starting to black things out. We can talk more about that. And then in the third section, it starts to have a very active memory, right? Recalling, like, good old days, and, like, you'll see this faded text that the memory of things you've read just keep coming back. So, yeah, it's also like the writing or the telling of the story kind of evolves as well. You do something radical. I kind of want to, maybe we should read a little bit.
Yeah, let's read a little bit before the trains start derailing.
Yeah, there's a major, major derailment in Maria's
book. It's a wild ride.
Yeah.
I have to say this periodically in the event.
Do you want to read first?
Okay, I will read first. Yes.
You want to say something? What are you going to read?
Okay, I'm going to read, about these fellows who are about to get into the trailer, okay? So as I mentioned, there's a bride, and she has a trailer full of snails. Well, it doesn't go well for her. The snails have basically all died. And so her conservation mission has not been doing well. So her trailer is essentially empty. And these activists, who are also taking part in the tours, they convince her to take part in this kidnapping scheme to kidnap a bunch of these Western bachelors as a big media stunt to show the world how awful these romance tours are. So this chapter is written from the perspective of one of the men who is about to get into the trailer. romantic getaway was starting any minute, Bertrand told Prasha, a bonus social. They'd have 2 hours to puzzle their way out of a mobile escape room, and once they did, they'd be at their destination, a pagan fertility party in the woods. The invitation was extremely exclusive, according to the woman who'd invited Bertrand. The men had been specially vetted by the brides who'd be at this party. Was Pasha a game? Bertrand asked. It was the last night of the romance tour. The theme was prom night, where the men wore suits and baby's breath boutonnieres, and the women swished around in long gowns. The night had begun primly, with bachelors and brides awkward as teenagers as they slow danced to soulful ballads, while Pasha hung back at the bar, pretending to peruse the leather-bound tome of cocktail offerings, pretending not to notice that the one bride he'd had hopes for, but who had not answered his date request, was doing a cross-armed shot with a long-haul driver from New Orleans. The MCs toast to the newly engaged couples, which did not improve Pasha's mood. After that, the lights dimmed and the techno pounded. Sweaty bodies writhed around as Pasha as he tipped back one overly complicated and Western-priced cocktail after another. And then we're gonna skip a little bit ahead. After his fourth cocktail, Pasha had at last admitted deep feet. He'd pushed through the crowds toward the exit, determined to pack up that very night, fly back to Vancouver on standby. That's when Bertrand had come out of nowhere, two shots in hand, and pulled him into a quiet back room with purple poofs and floor-to-ceiling aquarium of jellyfish, backlit and radioactive yellow. At first, Pasha said he'd pass on this exclusive romantic getaway. I didn't get the invitation anyway. Bertrand tipped back his shot. Ah, come on. I'll pull some strings. Look at you, man. How could they not let you in? You're as eligible as they come. Engineer, full head of hair. And then we have progressed now through the scene where they're getting more and more inebriated, and Bertrand is trying to convince Pasha to get into this trailer. Until finally, Bertrand gave Pasha a somber look. Have you ever watched a pigeon get laid? Pasha shook his head. Well, you should, Bertrand said. There's a lesson in there. He's all puffed up, he's bobbing and dancing circles around her, he's vibrating with love, and she's whacking at a piece of bread. Doesn't seem to notice him. And you know what? She's right. Takes a lot of work to make an egg. A lot of protein to chalk up, you know? She's gotta keep her gates on lockdown. That's her job. And it's the male's job to prove he's not just any male. He's not going away. He'll always be there. To take care of the chicks? Pasha said. No, you're overthinking it. You think pigeons look that far ahead? Neither should you. The pigeon just keeps dancing, dodging cars, people. He just dances till his tiny feet are raw against the pavement. She might be gone by the time he's done. In fact, it's not about her anymore. But maybe she is still there. A switch flips, her gates open. The women here in Ukraine, they're like that. Natural, traditional. They might look more interested in a bread crust than they are in you, but it's an act. So what are you gonna do, huh, Pasha? Are you gonna fly away, or are you gonna keep dancing? So would you get into this mobile lab, escape room, after that speech? I think you would.
It's great camaraderie between us. There's this great image in the book, right, of just the men are in the trailer of this truck, and it's like a snail traveling across a landscape, right, this obsession with snails, and then the men are in the shell of this snail. Question to pause on. We talk about writing characters of the other gender. Like, you write men well, right?
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, they're not all like this. Not all men, you know.
But that kind of like bro talk between two guys? You've been privy to this?
So sad that this is a recorded event. I have some friends who I will not name in certain parts of the world, in certain professions, who have a way of speaking to each other. Mm. Yes.
Yeah. It's authentic.
Thank you.
It's authentic. Okay, I will read from the first part of You've Changed. So Beckett has recently... Beckett works in construction. He's recently been fired from his job. That's going to set off a crisis in him. His wife, Princess, is a fitness instructor. So this is like a few days after being laid off. Day 7. Princess insisted he come to the gym with her. inside, not just a drop-off. He did one of her classes, and apparently he had muscle memory of the sense of physical failure, which was one reason he had stopped attending. Later, he hammered his leg with her massage gun, one of his better gifts to her. Later still, he slouched in front of the TV and folded origami shapes with shiny paper, one of her better gifts to him. Upstairs, she laid out workout clothes for him for the next day's class, as if he needed help to dress himself. She seemed to assume his unemployment meant a gym buddy for her. He said, "I'm not going back to the gym." "But you're so cute," she said. "They should have hired you instead of that young girl from Toronto. I heard they're planning to give her a yoga class at the same time as my stretch and strengthen. Like what? She barely has 200 hours of training." "I can get her fired," Beckett said. "I have the magic touch. When we go tomorrow, I'll show you who she is." "I'm done with gyms," Beckett sighed. "I want to stay home and get fat." She scrunched up her face. They both knew it wasn't true. Since he lost his job, he still woke at 6:30, still wanted to leave the house and arrive someplace that needed him by 7:30. Even if that meant roaming the aisles of Home Depot and bringing home a six-pack of work gloves. If Home Depot sold food and clothes, he'd never shop anywhere else. "You're going back to running?" Princess asked. And as soon as she said it, he knew that was the answer. Her intuition allowed her to predict his responses with uncanny accuracy. They had not been married 20, 10, or even 5 years, but she sometimes knew him better than he knew himself, like autocomplete in a search bar. He hadn't run in a long time, 5 years, not since his dog Pointy had died. But maybe he could run again. He could go through the stretches and run through the dark neighborhood to disco. He liked the nightlife. He liked to boogie. Maybe it was time for a new dog. "Starting in the morning," he said. "Good for you," Princess said. That made Beckett testy. His energy was pent up. "You could run through the dog park," she said, again predicting what he'd do. Beckett still frequented the dog park because some of Pointy's ashes were there. But to maintain his independence, Beckett said, "No, I was going to run around the golf course." "Oh, yeah?" "Yeah. Fine, do it." "I will." "Well, good. Good. Go ahead. Starting tomorrow." She laughed. Even his testiness she found cute. To remind her of her mocking laughter, that night when she reached for him, Beckett crane lifted her hand from his body and told her that he had to run in the morning, so he needed his sleep. Thank you very much. So petty. So petty.
Yeah. Well, yeah, a lot of the scenes, the marriage scenes in your novel are so, so tense.
Yeah.
And there's like a scorecard that I saw, you know? So that scene, yeah, Beckett 1, Princess 0.
Right. And these things eventually accumulate, right? So the changes are so incremental in this story that you don't even realize that the marriage has shifted under your watch, right? Like, he's just saying he's going to run, and there was a little fight about that. He said maybe you should get a little bit more filler in the lip, and now she's tense about that. And then, like, it just keeps building and building and building, and suddenly, like, who is this person? Right? Yeah.
So we talked about kind of writing outside of our knowledge, in a way. So I figured maybe we could talk about our research. Ooh. And I know that you took an entire course on how to build a house, because Beckett is, he builds houses.
Right.
Talk about that.
Yeah, so how to, this is like the Stanislavski method or something of writing a book, right? Like, you have to do the thing to write it. So I was like seized by this idea a few years ago, right? I wanted to write about someone who was like a very ordinary person, a very sort of regular guy. So the guy who goes to Home Depot who doesn't have novels written about him. Someone who doesn't read the novels that you write about him. The guy who buys, you know, gloves and filters and keeps track of when to sort of replace the batteries and the smoke detector. And I like needed to get into that person's head. This started before this. There was another novel where I needed to sew, right? Because someone was sewing their own bridal dress. And so to do that, I had to figure out, like, where does your mind go when you're stitching something, right? It's not just about the act of, like, knowing technique. But those patterns, you remember them from, like, the 80s? I'm thinking of my mother's patterns. They would come in the mail. You would sort of clip along the dotted lines and then, like, make a whole dress out of them. So, like, I'm stitching for a while and trying to figure out how that worked. And so for Beckett, I was like, okay, so what is this contract to do on a daily basis? And you're hammering a nail, or you've got a nail gun, and you're trying to, like, not kill yourself or, like, you know, shoot at somebody when you're... There's a kind of focus that's there, but you've done it enough that you can actually let the other parts of your life kind of bubble up. Mm. And so, yeah, I really just kind of wanted to see, like, how does time work when you're engaged in something that is dusty, that is dangerous, that has you in heights, that has you teetering, that has you working with a bunch of other people of various degrees of commitment to their job. So, yeah, I took this course. There were two parts. There was, like, this theoretical part that you did for 5 weeks in front of a laptop, and this guy would tell you about, like, electrical and what to connect to what and what not to connect to what. And then we went into a warehouse, and in 6 weeks we built this house inside of a warehouse, which was crazy. The amount of yelling at I have not experienced since, like, grade school, right? And then you realize, like, not all jobs are all people sending you polite emails, right? Like, can you do this? Are you available then? Like, no, it's like, stand the freaking wall until, right? Like, there's some real abuse.
It's a very efficient form of communication.
And some people
yes.
need it, I think. Right? Some people respond to that. And other people are every day going home like, she didn't need to be like that, like, talking to us. She could just tell us what you wanted us to do. Yeah, and folks would slack off and stuff like that. So that's research for me. Your research, is it all snail websites? If I looked at your browsing history?
Well, I mean, yeah, my browsing history probably has landed on some weird lists, you know, watch lists. But so I was kind of burbling along with my plot, you know, researching snails and the marriage industry, and I read a lot of self-published books about how to date Ukrainian women and learned a lot about kind of my own species. Yeah. And
written by men.
They're always written by men. Yeah. And they're kind of like, I'll give you the secret, you know, to unlock the Slavic woman and the secret to your happiness. And so, yeah, I learned a lot. And so I was moving along. I was 4 years into the book. The train was, you know, on its tracks.
Yeah.
And then Russia invaded Ukraine. And my relatives back in Ukraine were calling from across the country saying that they were fleeing their homes. They were hearing explosions. And then all of them had to leave their homes except for one of them, my grandfather. And so I was born in Ukraine, and I've, you know, I grew up in Canada and I've visited many times. So I maintain a connection there. And at that moment, I gave up on this novel. I thought, how can I keep writing this book when its setting is being destroyed in real time? And this premise of romance tours, like, it's done. Snails, I mean, they remain endangered, but in my mind, it's done. So I gave up on it. I wrote a totally different novel, which did not go so well. and then I kept obsessing over these questions of what is my role as a storyteller in these very uncertain times? What's the role of fiction to respond to our insane reality? Especially when we're watching something from abroad, so we're trying to, you know, live our mundane lives here while atrocities are happening.
So you're
elsewhere.
Getting your information from, like, CNN, from the news, and...
There were multiple sources. There was one source called Live Maps, and I guess this is a facet of modern warfare is that you have all these different lenses into the war now. So on live maps, you can look at a map of Ukraine day by day since the invasion, and there are these geolocated pieces of footage from civilians about different parts of the country. So, you know, somebody who was filming a tank as it just crunched on top of a civilian car, right? So all of these things. So, I watched a lot of pretty graphic imagery, and then I decided to go to Ukraine on a research trip with my sister, and we spent 5 weeks there. And at that point, and I still couldn't really write fiction at that point. And so I was doing research, but it was kind of for this amorphous goal. I wasn't really sure what it was for. And of course, to see my relatives as well. But
Everybody's telling you you can't go back. There's a war on. You can't go back at all.
Yeah.
What sort of tipped you over? What made you think like you could go back safely to do this? Or
I mean, I didn't know. I didn't know that anything could be safe. But we would just, so my sister and I just decided we would start at the kind of so-called safest part of Ukraine, so the westernmost part, and then just kind of see what our comfort levels were. And something I noticed, and it's kind of disturbing looking back, but your sense of risk becomes quite normalized after a while. So it's like the first time we heard an air raid siren, I mean, immediately this animal instinct to hide, right? But because nobody around me was panicking, because they'd heard those sirens so many times, and we're herd animals, so if the herd is not panicking, you find yourself, oh, then I should panic, right? Because, yeah, the sirens have become normalized in many ways. So it's like you think, okay, well, nothing's happened to me so far, so maybe I can push it a little more. I can go a little bit further east, right? So anyway, to get back to the question of research, right? I found that, yeah, I wasn't writing fiction at that point, but I was writing these diary-like entries to kind of, first to deal with the terror of preparing for this trip, and then while in Ukraine, just recording what I saw, and kind of as a way to treat reality as material, almost like a psychological distancing technique. Like, if I can write about it, I can kind of have some control over it, and I can keep my distance from it, which, of course, is not really true, but we tell ourselves stories as we're telling stories, right? So yeah, in the end, I knew I had to be there to write about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself becoming more courageous as you're there, or is there a numbness that's there?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a numbness, and it's a self... I found kind of almost like a self-delusion. Like, yeah, again, if nothing's happened to me so far, yeah, I'm safe, I can keep going. And, well, look at those, you know, look at that city. People are trying to live their normal lives, so maybe I can go there.
Right.
And, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, how far do you go for a novel, right? Like, so, I'm working with power tools. I still have my fingers, my toes, my limbs, right? I'm okay. You're going into, like, a war territory for a novel that you thought had maybe died, right? And you're trying to figure another way into it. Yeah, it's bizarre to me, right? The lengths that we go. And sometimes you can't quite, there's no physical act that you can point to see the extent that novelists or writers go to. But the kind of like internal psychological plumbing, like there's material there that you don't want to deal or access, but you must do it if you want to write fiction properly. Right?
Yeah, we did hit a limit. So we went as far as Kharkiv, which is very, very close to the Russian border, and there's very, very little time for a warning when the missiles do come. So we went there, but we could not go to where my grandfather is. So he's in Kherson, and he's the only family member who has stayed. And because we couldn't go there, and that felt too unsafe, that's when my fiction started to turn into almost like this fantasy of rescuing him. So that's kind of the dream element of the book, is how does our fiction bleed into our real life, and how do the two interweave?
So this is like the fascinating thing about the book. You're reading along, you're all invested in the story, what's going to happen, right? There's a bit of a heist going on. And then, oh, does it... It won't give it away, right, to say this, right? Okay. Halfway through, no, I want you. You should do it. Right?
Well, yeah, when I give up on the book, and yeah, the invasion is happening, like, you see that derailment in the book, and the book turns into a completely different form and structure. So, broadly speaking, it starts as fiction and it ends as nonfiction.
Yeah.
And yeah, my grandfather's a character in it. I'm a character in it. So you, I kind of draw back the curtain in how does the author keep writing this novel, right, and the ethics behind it too.
Yeah. And bizarrely, everybody, so my trouble with metafiction is sometimes you lose your investment in it, right? You think like, oh, this is not real, the stakes are so low. But like all throughout your book, everybody seems real. Everybody seems, even the fictional characters seem to operate on the plane of reality. It's not like you become fiction, but rather like they become real, right? They suddenly like step out of the book into this real world that we're living in, rather than the opposite. I mean, that would have been a failed attempt, right? If everything flattened at the appearance of the war. But no, instead, everything got dimension at the appearance of the war. When you did that, then tricking the second part there.
Thank you. It was really the only way I could write it.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the kind of more experimental facets of your book as well.
But nobody told you to cut the metafiction. I know.
Oh, right. Okay. Okay.
Last question.
Yes. Yes. No, I cut the metafiction at some point.
Yeah.
So before showing anybody the book, I kind of I got squeamish about it, and I thought, nah, this is too weird. So I cut it all out, and I tried to write the book straight, and I realized, oh, well, the energy is gone from me, and it doesn't actually work anymore. So then I realized, oh, well, if it's an essential part of the book, then it has to be in there, and. Fortunately, yeah, my agents and my editors were very supportive of it.
Experimental. So I have to be like excited about something formally in a book for me to sort of persist with it. Like the story has to be interesting to me. I love the characters and all that. But then the book itself has to be surprising and interesting and kind of have a life of its own. I really think about it as like an organism of its own. So the characters have life, they resemble humans, but the book, what kind of beast is it, right? Like, how does it move and behave and sort of work, walk through space? Reproduction is full of, like, all of these kinds of, there's a cancer text, and there's the multiplying of chapters and perspectives and all of that. And in this book, it's, but sort of memory and recursivity and like also sense strength. So there's all this stuff happening in Florida at the time. I was working on the Massey lectures at the same time as this. And so I'm thinking about censorship. I'm thinking about what we're not allowed to say. And then the book does this very literal thing about starting to like black out words that are not acceptable on TV, right? A very sort of literal kinds of thing, like you see if the word like cock is there, but you mean like a chicken or something like that. That word has to go, regardless of context. Right? It's a real draconian and senseless kind of censorship that happens. It was great. So my editor, Ann, is back there. Great at finding balance. I can sort of go like a bit extreme with things, and then Ann will say, point made, right? You've done enough. Don't overdo it. It's distracting at this point, right? And so to find that balance, the book wanted to, you don't want to be too cute or too clever or too anything like that. You've got to find that right balance where we get it and the technique is productive rather than distracting here. Yeah.
Well, something I get asked, and I wonder if you also get asked, is, yeah, if you received pushback from your editors, and I find that actually having a trusting relationship with an editor is what helps push you further, because yet you can take more risks, and having this kind of other set of eyes, you know, balance you out a little
bit.
I actually think it's really wonderful. I went further than I would have otherwise gone.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
And if I just started like turning words on the page and all of that, I think Anne was for, you need someone, I need a little bit of restraint, right? I need a little bit of like, that's enough, settle down, you got it out of your system. That's good, right? But what like Ann and Sarah are very good at doing for me is asking those questions about why is he like this? What happened in his childhood? Why does he feel like this? Where's the feeling? And yes, a lot of this can be suppressed, but just a few gestures here and there can say, tell me about his mom, tell me a bit more about that Thanksgiving. Like those kinds of questions that will sort of like, I don't know, like raise the volume on the emotional life of the book. Yeah, that's one of the things I appreciate.
So we both work in multiple forms, right? So you write poetry, nonfiction, I write scripts for opera as well. And so I'm always thinking about the content versus the container.
Yeah.
Right? So when I'm working through my content, whatever the story is, and then I'm always thinking, is this the right container for this?
Right. You use the word container instead of form, like you.
Yeah, I use the word container.
Scared. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I don't know, a container. First of all, I just love containers. I love them. Like Tupperware is my jam. So I'm always thinking, what is the perfect container for this? Because I don't take them for granted, right? So when even chapter by chapter, if I hit a chapter where it just doesn't want to be written as straight prose,
yeah.
I go, well, maybe this is actually meeting minutes or something like that. Maybe it's
you
a dialogue. Yeah.
Your container.
Yeah, I change my container.
Yeah.
Do you think about your container?
I don't use the word container, right? So I used to use the form content thing, right? Content versus form. But now the preferred term for me is like content versus arrangement, right? And arrangement for me signals both like something musical, right? Like this is a new way of telling a story that probably has archetypal history. But also arrangement for me feels like more sequenced and more like task oriented, right? So how can I arrange this material? So in a story that might be, it's a marriage here, but how can I arrange the telling of the story in a way that is fresh and, you know, full of life and livening and all of that? Yeah, and that's a real sort of like poetry kind of thing about juxtaposition and positioning and what two things, if I can put two things together, what is the unsaid energy that will now be activated versus, you know, me saying 4 months later this or that happened, right? Just put a memory next to the thing that triggers the memory, and I don't have to explain the connection, right?
Right, because if the text is a little bit more like a faded gray,
right.
You can layer those things really beautifully,
right.
With the fully black text,
right?
Right? There's different colors of text in this.
Yeah, so we call it the memory text when we were working on it, right? So in part three, all the memories come back, and instead of saying, Beckett recalled when he was a boy, his friend John, he'll have Beckett say eating an ice cream, and then John liked chocolate, right? And you know, because you've been there before, and you build this memory along with us. And so that kind of signaling, you just change the font a little bit, and you know we're back in time, and there's some kind of triggering happening there. Yeah. Yeah, it's efficient.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just thinking. I'm going to retreat into myself for a little bit, thinking about that. Yeah, this doesn't work on camera, right?
I think so. In your book, there's a really beautiful moment where, because we start in third person, right? So it's Beckett this and Beckett this and etc. And then there's something that happens to him physically, which I don't want to give away, but it's like a visceral thing. And then suddenly he comes into his body, and we get into the first person perspective,
right.
So it becomes I.
Right.
And that gives it so much energy as well.
Yeah, there's this moment, like, I think every text has this sort of crisis or breaking point, right? You're writing along, and you get to that place where you're done with the novel, right? Right where the metafiction begins. And yeah, it's a little bit through part two, and then the book, picture like Celine Dion singing a power ballad, and she sung the same chorus a few times, and then the key changes, and suddenly it's a whole new song, and it's magical, and the world, like, opens up, and that's what it feels like, right? This key changes shift of perspective from third to first, and then something else in part three, and to do it just... like, not make a big deal over it, right? Mm-hmm. Just do it, and then suddenly it's a new book, right? Suddenly we're looking out a different window. Yeah. Yeah, I see you doing similar kinds of things, though, right? Like, you're just picking the moments of crisis, and instead of retreating from those moments of crisis, you're sort of pushing your finger down and saying, mm-hmm. I'm going to break the text here, and let's see what happens, right? I feel like that's the best of the metafiction.
Yeah. I mean, in real life, I definitely retreated from that point of crisis. Went under a rock for a while. but because those things kept obsessing me, I knew that I had to keep going with it, find some way to write about it.
Can I switch to something totally different? So you put all of this work into a novel. You have all of this hope for it. We lived for a long time, for years, just you and the novel. maybe some trusted readers. And then, I don't know, the Booker people call you and say, hey, we love this, you're on the long list there. How does that feel?
It felt really strange. Very, very nice, of course, and I'm very, very grateful and honored. With this book, because it was so difficult to write, and I gave up on it multiple times, and then the editorial process was really intense. So at that point, I just wanted to finish the darn thing.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't really see any future for it beyond, I'm going to just meet this deadline. So, and now this future is here, and now there's this kind of public-facing component of it, and it feels, like I didn't envision it at all, which is good. It's a good place to, because when you have expectations when you publish, I think that you're setting yourself up for...
Disappointment,
right.
One of my favorite words.
Yeah. So it's good to start in a place of no expectation, I think.
Right. Where were you when you heard, or how did you find out?
I was house-sitting in Montreal, and there was some buzz around the Booker prediction Instagram. Because, yeah, on the internet, there's whole communities around predicting Booker stuff. And so, there were, you know, my book came out on those, and I really tried to block it out. Then my editor from the UK texted me saying, hey, we have some good news. Do you have time to chat? And they never text me. It's usually email.
Right.
So that's when I found out.
Right.
Yeah.
You weren't sitting in front of you to be like refreshing the book.
No. I was really trying to stay out of it. Yeah.
That's good. That's healthy, right? I think that's
Yeah, and it was a strange feeling because... Yeah, the book is so personal, and suddenly more and more people know about it.
Yeah.
And my grandfather, who is the main character by the end of this book, does not know about this book, actually.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I feel like the book is slowly cornering him, and maybe one day it'll be translated into Ukrainian, and he'll find out.
He's one of my favorite people in the book, so the fact that he doesn't know in real life, I feel like he would love seeing himself, right? Like, he would love to see himself represented.
I don't know. I have no idea, really. It's
So why haven't you told him?
He decided to stay in his city, in Kherson, while it was, first it was occupied by the Russians, then it was liberated, and then the dam was flooded. The dam was exploded, so the region flooded, and now the city is basically like a human safari where the drones are targeting civilians almost as training practice. And so throughout all of that, he has stayed, and we've tried to convince him to leave, and we couldn't. And part of this book is actually me trying to come to terms with that decision, and I mean, I just didn't understand it at the time. But I think it's that, if he's going to go, and he's going to go on his own terms and his own debt, right?
Yeah.
And,
What would he think?
Well, I think... he already knows we're worried about him.
Yeah.
And to have a whole book about that worry being presented to him, I don't think that would help. And when I myself was in Ukraine, and I had friends, after certain attacks, I would get text messages from them, like, are you okay? And I had this feeling of, well, I know I'm okay right now. Almost like you're worrying by choice. I'm not putting this worry on you. And I know that's not exactly a good thing to think, but I guess I didn't want to put my worry on him anymore.
He has enough.
Yeah, he has enough. Yeah. So I mean, I just chickened out.
Part of me just really wants him to know this, right? You know when you've been, like, someone has taken a really good photograph of you? You want, like, that person to see it? And so there's something in that, like, this is how I see you, and this is, and you look good in this light, and I hope he gets to see it at some point, right?
Yeah, perhaps. Yeah. Have you had readers read themselves into your characters if they weren't, family members or friends, and me into this character?
Probably, but I hope not, right? This is, like, where you want, like, huge letters, like, size 40 font, this is a work of fiction, like, there. But it is, a bit flattering if people think, like, this is about them, or if this is about, like, a relationship or whatever, because it means, like, your reality, the reality that you're building there is actually very persuasive and convincing. And then to sort of say to them, I don't know, I think people maybe want to be stars to a degree, right? And to believe, like, this is about you. I think maybe there are elements of myself that would sort of competingly say, like, Ian, you're a princess, Ian, you're Beckett, Ian, you're gluten, right? Because I do give slivers of myself to each of these different characters. So when I read it, there are things in each character that I can sort of identify with and recognize, right? That's how I get close to them. But I mean, my characters are so messed up that I really don't want, you know, my dad or my brother to say, like, oh, you really didn't enjoy childhood or whatever. Like, he's like, no, it's not about you. But you use that detail, the Toyota is in there. It's not your Toyota. You know? So,
yeah. Your family doesn't read your works, though, right?
No, not typically.
Okay.
No,
okay.
That's for the
best. That's lucky. I think that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. If I could just write under a pet name and a different identity and help. Who was that nonfiction writer? Totally. Oh, it was a scam. It was a fraud. Withdraw that. Yeah. Yeah.
Some pointers to take from that person.
Right. But are you afraid that when you go forward writing now, after the successes of the last two books, that somehow you'll be changed when you go back to the page? Like, you'll be a different kind of writer, either A, feeling the pressure to write for success, right? Mm-hmm. B, feeling the need to write, like, a timely book that sort of has its pulse on, like, global events. Do you feel yourself being molded or shaped into the future?
Well, I mean, good question, yeah. I feel that with every new project I start, I have to game myself into it in some way. So when I was writing my first book, I felt like I could do anything with it because I didn't think anybody would actually read it. I could just be in the sandbox by myself.
Yeah.
And then once people did read it, and I couldn't delude myself anymore.
Yeah.
So with my second book, I had to game myself into just calling it a pet project. In fact, I wrote a totally, yeah, when I gave up on this book, I wrote a totally different book that I didn't tell anybody about, my publishers, my agent, nobody, and I don't, recommend this strategy, but that way I could delude myself to thinking nobody's going to read this, so
yeah.
I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
With my next book, so my next delusion is going to be that because this book is so complex, there's a really big cast of characters, and it's doing all these things with form and multiple perspectives. My next file is just going to be called Short and Simple Book. So my laser focus is that and not the public,
right.
Like whatever the public perception of it, because
right.
Ultimately I have no control over the public perception. Yeah.
I think we have similar kinds of dreams here, to write like a really tight 150-page book, like a really pared-down, like, single story. But my brain doesn't quite work that way, right? It might start off that way.
You start off that way, right?
Yeah, you got like one plot line, and then you're like, oh, but what about this person's story, or this person's? And so the layers keep like accruing.
But that's an organic process.
Yeah, it starts one way. But maybe I just should stop before all this other stuff happens, right? Like, you just stop after year three instead of year five.
Yeah. Well, I'll return the question to you. I mean, you won the Giller, and right now you're on the long list. And so you've had a very, very public reception to your work. So how has that affected your process?
For fiction, everything still takes long, right? Like, it takes a long time, but I do feel, like, really free. And I mean, I started off writing poems and like low stakes, right? You know, I could do whatever I wanted. But I do feel like I could pursue and tell a story in whatever way that I want to do it, and not feel like subject to the market or to pressure or to whatever, that I can just actually follow my imagination. And that's a great thing. I think that's good fortune to not have to worry. So prizes can go two ways, right? You can win a prize young or early, and it can really mess you up psychologically, right? It can really make you think that I must continue doing the same thing if I'm to continue being successful, right? I've seen writers fall into this pattern. And the other thing it could do is to say, like, hey, you trusted your instincts for this thing that was prize winning, and you should continue to trust your instincts going forward without fear of public reception. Like, you've got goodwill on your side. It's going to be okay if you're being authentic and true to the project, right? And I think that second feeling of, like, real freedom is important for me to produce. And that's, I think, the advantage of being successful a little bit later.